listening to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Candace.
And my name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we'll be hearing an interview with the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement's New York City chapter. The Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, is a new revolutionary anarchist organization that recently released a book called Burn Down the American Plantation. In the interview, RAM talks about their book, their strategy for revolution, and what inspires them. But first, here on the show, we bring you some news headlines.
Egypt's highest appeals court has upheld a sentence of 5 years in prison and 5 years probation for Alaa Abd El Fattah, one of the country's most prominent pro-democracy activists. The ruling is final and cannot be appealed. El Fattah has served 3.5 years of the sentence already, so he will spend the next year and a half in prison, according to democracynow.org. The probation means he will have to spend up to 12 hours a day in a police station for another 5 years once he is released. El Fattah was convicted of inciting a 2013 protest that broke a law barring public gatherings without government approval. He's also on trial in another case of insulting the judiciary with a verdict scheduled in December. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-backed government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has arrested or charged at least 60,000 people forcibly disappeared, hundreds for months at a time, handed down preliminary death sentences to hundreds more, and sent more than 15,000 civilians to military courts.
The intensification of the so-called war on drugs continues in the Philippines since the country's president, Rodrigo Duterte, took office in June of 2016. Thousands of drug users and dealers have been killed in police operations or by vigilantes. Thousands more have been arrested and crammed into prisons, like in Quezon City Jail, which sometimes holds 4,000 people in an area built to hold 800.
The four lost ownership to their own artwork, paintings, drawings, and even sculptures created while shackled to the floor. According to the Miami Herald, the U.S. Pentagon has decided to claim ownership of all creative works made inside the detention center, and officials may even decide to burn them.
In Washington, D.C., jury selection has begun in the first trial of the nearly 200 people arrested during U.S. President Donald Trump's inauguration. On January 20th, the day of the inauguration, over 230 people were arrested by the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department during protests against the inauguration of Donald Trump. The mass arrest, or kettle, cut off an entire street corner and swept up every person within proximity to an anti-capitalist and anti-fascist march. A report issued from the Office of Police Complaints states that the police, without issuing the mandated warning or dispersal orders and without provocation, unleashed chemical weapons and concussion grenades as a method of crowd control. Detainees were kept standing for over 8 hours without access to food, water, or medical attention. Some were forced to urinate on themselves or in the street. Some of the protesters are now facing felony charges and up to 75 years in prison. The first trial involves six people, including one journalist, Alexi Wood, a freelance photojournalist and videographer based in San Antonio. The activist group Defend J20 Resistance are demanding that the U.S. Attorney's Office drop the Inauguration Day mass arrest charges and end the persecution of anti-Trump protesters. Defend J20 Resistance states on their website that it is our task to challenge the U.S. government's effort to reanimate the Riot Act. We must also challenge the false divisions between acceptable and unacceptable protest.
The Mohawk Band Council of Akwesasne introduced what is considered the first indigenous legal system in Canada outside of a federal framework, according to White Wolf Pack News. While First Nations band councils have been passing and enforcing legislation on reserves across the country for decades, those bylaws are either tied to the Indian Act or within a Gulf government agreement with the federal government. What's special about the new court law passed by the Council of Akwesasne is that it was drafted by the community and independently of Ottawa. The council decided to mix aspects of Canada's justice system with Mohawk values and principles, such as considering the talents of the offending party and using them to benefit the community. For example, if someone spray paints graffiti on a school wall and the offender is a great lacrosse player, the law stipulates the person can be ordered to teach students how to play the sport. There are no jail terms, with sanctions based on the concept of restorative justice and the objective of helping restore relationships and harmony in the community. The Akwesasne Reserve straddles the Quebec, Ontario, and New York State borders.
In local news, AIDS Community Care Montreal has started to fund started a fund to support paying the cost of bail for people who have been charged in relation to HIV non-disclosure, exposure, and or transmission. They have already used the fund to pay for one person's bail, according to a local AIDS Action activist. There has been a recent spike in charges around Montreal, and this kind of support can make a big difference in a person's life. And if you are interested in making a donation to the fund to support paying the cost of bail for people who have been charged in relation to HIV non-disclosure, you can contact ACCM Montreal directly. Their email address is info@accmmontreal.org.
We now bring you the intro with Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM. In this first part of our interview, RAM talks about the central ideas in their book, Burn Down the American Plantation. They also talk about taking inspiration from the struggle for liberation in Rojava, a mostly Kurdish area in northern Syria.
Can you start by introducing yourselves and your project?
Okay, yeah, we're the New York City RAM branch. That's the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, the New York City chapter.
Can you talk about the context in which this project started, both the book that you guys wrote, which was called Burn Down the American Plantation, and the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement as a group?
Okay, yeah, so we've been organizing at the base for a number of years. Done a lot of, like, organizing projects, Tenant Solidarity Network, Cop Watch, a lot of other activities. We wanted to tie it all together with kind of revolutionary underpinning, but also, like, a political trajectory that's legible to the outside world. So no matter what we're doing, if we're doing a tenants network, if we're doing Cop Watch, people will always know why you're doing it, what the goals are.
Yeah, and a lot of our organizing efforts, it stems from like a longer history of anarchist organizing from like the anti-globe period to Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter. And we noticed that there wasn't a clear trajectory from the struggles from 19th century abolitionism to the civil rights movement to the black liberation struggles to what we're facing now. And Black Lives Matter is one of the clearest iterations of that, but we want to make sure that same consistency comes through in all of our fighting and organizing.
So let's start by talking about the book, Burn Down the American Plantation. Can you share some of the central ideas that you were trying to get across in the book?
So basically, what we're essentially arguing is that there's really nothing to be redeemed within these institutions of American society, as they're all fundamentally premised on like anti-blackness and, you know, the subjugation and like the violent destruction of various other peoples and communities. But primarily, America has always been kind of like founded and instituted on this kind of like anti-black violence, which is kind of just, all pervasive. It's kind of the bedrock of American society. And so what we're kind of trying to outline in this text is basically recalibrating kind of like the direction of the anarchist movement more towards an abolitionist kind of framework that centers on, you know, the black struggle and liberating and helping, black people and other oppressed populations, you know, escape from state violence, but also lay the groundwork for building a new society.
A lot of the examples of long-term goals in the book are drawn from the struggle in Rojava. Can you guys talk about why you chose to do that?
Yeah, definitely. We chose to draw from a lot of the organizational models in Rojava because, interestingly enough, that struggle had pivoted towards a more anarchist way of organizing and laid out like a groundwork for how that could work from the neighborhood council to the defense bodies, to conflict resolution and feminism. So we draw from the ideals presented by that revolution, and we're learning from what's happening on the ground, the kind of messy implementation, the imperfections, the realpolitik, and those are things that we can learn from for our own struggle. But mostly, like, we're interested in it because it's happening right now, so we can learn about it in real time. People that we know from the struggle or have come from similar backgrounds have gone there, so we can learn from their experiences. And mostly, the models that they put forward resonate with the ideals that we want to push in terms of decentralization, localized control, and defense is like a central tenet.
Can you talk about the role of prison in your analysis in the book?
Thank you. Well, it's fairly central in that we argue in the text that slavery was never abolished, that it just transformed. So it went from the plantation system in the 19th century to the prison industrial complex in the U.S. Today. It's like the predominant focus is on destroying prisons and prison society.
So some people engage with the idea of abolitionism through the lens of prison abolition. Can you guys talk about how the abolitionism of RAM is or isn't connected to prison abolition?
It's obviously connected to the abolition of prisons, but also prison is not just like just some institution. You know, society can also be a prison, and in many black communities, you know, it essentially is a prison for these people. And so it's not so much just about like abolishing prisons, but basically abolishing prison society. You know, society has become its own kind of like prison. And so, you know, that's more the framework that we come from, and not just like just isolated, but like holistic. So.
Yeah, I'd like to add something too, that the abolitionist struggle, while it is for prison abolition and other abolition of the state, capital, and all these other heinous institutions, we're also trying to relate to the abolitionist struggle from the 19th century and saying there's a trajectory from that with the abolition of slavery to abolishing slavery in its current form, which is the prison industrial complex.
It's important to note that prison abolition doesn't happen in a vacuum. Like, you're not going to have prisons without the justice system. You're not going to have a justice system without the state. So essentially, to have prison abolition, you have to tear down the entire state, which makes the anarchist solution the most logical one.
So on your website, you have two projects on the go. One is the Kwasi Balagun Liberation School, and one is RAM Prisoner Support. Can you talk about both of these projects and explain how they're connected to your medium and longer-term goals and strategies?
Okay, well, the Kwasi Balagun Liberation School is something a little different than most anarchists traditionally do, in that it's a bit of a formal process. It's a month-long series of workshops and presentations that starts with an introductory lecture about... it starts with an ideological and pragmatic and historical lecture about what we're doing, what we intend to do, and how we intend to do it. And then we have a series of other pragmatic workshops that go along to get people used to what we're doing and to see if they agree with where we're coming from and what we're trying to do. So it's a way of building a tighter, more cohesive team, but also a way of introducing people to what we're doing in a fairly respectable fashion. Now, the RAM Prisoner Support Project is modeled after East Bay Prisoner Support, where they send zines of revolutionary literature into prison. And we all heard about that idea. We're like, it's so awesome. It needs to spread further. So we implemented it ourselves. And we've been writing letters to political prisoners and other people with a zine catalog with about 25 texts with Frank Wilderson, Alfredo Bonanno, a bunch of other people we're inspired by. And we're sending literature into prisons now. And we're also sending our texts to Burn Down the American Plantation.
There have been two new RAM chapters started since the original one here in New York City. Can you talk a bit about how different RAM chapters relate to each other? How much autonomy do different chapters have? And how would people go about starting a new chapter if they wanted to?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to get in contact with us and let us know you're down. We're always looking for folks that want to start new RAM chapters. Ideally, like, they'll be in every city, there'll be a couple in every city, that would be the best possible outcome. So far, people have just gotten in touch if they read the book and they relate with what we're trying to do. How it works is kind of being formed at this very minute. So we're hoping that we can start a different kind of anarchist organization in one sense, where there's kind of like very deep kind of like localized decision making, but where also we can like coordinate with each other and offer each other different kinds of material support. One reason is because like everybody in their local area, they know like what needs to be done there, what are the biggest issues, who are the people that would relate with these ideas the most. So it makes a lot of sense for projects to be dictated by those local conditions. But the main thing is we really want like what we're trying to do to be legible more broadly. So the more chapters that exist in different places, the more people that are active, then the more our activities will become legible to a broader audience, and people can join like that.
And also, there are several other collectives that are going to be announcing rather soon, so it's just beginning of a process, and if people have a desire to make a chapter, just shoot us a message, and we can talk about how to make that happen.
You've also talked about starting up a bail fund project. I know that that's like newly in the works. Mm-hmm. Can you guys talk a bit about your experiences with revolutionary service provision? And how do you combat dynamics inherited from state social services that can bleed into your projects?
I mean, I guess the fundamental difference between like what we're trying to do and what like, you know, NGOs and other groups like that do is that, you know, they look at it more as a job for them to do. You know, they get paid to do it. You know, they may or may not interact with these people outside of work or whatever. But, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, lay the groundwork for, like, you know, a revolutionary form of communitarianism. And that includes, you know, supporting people, you know, who are targeted by the prison system and the larger carceral state system. And so we're trying to just basically include them into kind of this, like, you know, revolutionary community so that they can, you know, get that support to, you know, fend off attacks from the state, but also, you know, have the ability to, like, develop themselves into, you know, like, revolutionary persons, and, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah. I'd also like to add that usually with a lot of radical movements in the U.S., people make a big separation between people who are, like, throwing rocks or smashing things or, like, attacking cops and people who are, like, helping people in their neighborhoods. And we're trying to kind of, like, break that barrier down. And we think that, like, militant groups that have broken that barrier have historically been more successful. Like, when people thought about the Black Panthers, they think about the guns and the shootouts, but they also think about the breakfast program. They don't think it's two separate things. So we're trying to, like, break that dichotomy. And most groups who have started successful, like, social kind of programs have always been successful because you end up actually placing yourself where people need you to be as opposed to placing yourself where you want to be.
The other fundamental difference from this and, like, service projects is that generally, like, NGOs and other service provision, any state apparatus for dealing with any, like, mental health problems or anything like that, tends to, like, keep a separation between the people who are being treated and the people who are giving the treatment. And our ultimate goal is to bring these people into the process of making decisions about their own, like, support and about the process of, like, actually, you know, changing the systems that oppress them initially.
The time is presently 11:20 a.m., and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
You are currently listening to an interview with the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement's New York City chapter. In the second part of our interview, Ram lays out some of their strategies for revolution, including centering self-defense, building an underground railroad, and the creation of neighborhood councils.
So I have some quotes in here from an article that you guys wrote in that got published in Truth Out magazine. And one of the quotes I really liked was, the purpose of this defense team, which it's talking about like a rapid response network and a defense team. So you guys wrote, the purpose of this defense team at this point is to literally be on call to defend our center from fascists and to defend our political infrastructure that we're building, such as safe houses or the rapid response network. We're hoping that if we can establish good modes of operation, this team can eventually train neighborhood teams in self-defense and political organization. So with that quote in mind, I'm curious what kind of threats can activate the defense team, and I'm also curious if you've all looked at histories of transformative justice organizing and community accountability work for ways to model this. From my perspective, it seems like there's connections to be made in terms of that kind of organizing.
Yeah, right now the defense is pretty much how it's described, like as a rapid response. So if there's an immediate threat, then people will come out for it. In that model, incorporating like conflict resolution and more long-term forms of kind of supporting like kind of neighborhood, I won't say justice because that's the wrong word, but transformative relationships. I think that's something that is being developed right now, something we don't even have answers to in our own communities and want to develop it for our own communities as well as our growing communities. So that's something that's in the process of being developed, and we're implementing like some small ways of doing that with all the trainings that we do in the form of the tech meal. So having like a period of reflection on how the group is going, how people are doing. People can critique like themselves.
So you guys mentioned the colonization of indigenous peoples in your book, and you position slavery at the center of your historical and political analysis. In the Canadian context, a critique of settler colonialism feels like it's at the forefront of a lot of anarchist analysis. I'm curious what led to your choices around like analysis placement in the book and how you guys see your analysis of slavery relating to settler colonialism.
A lot of the text, as people may not have noticed, is rooted in the Afro-pessimism of Frank Wilderson and Sadiata Hartman. So we kind of view this as like a foundational thing for the formation of the slave process and the process of establishing a world based on anti-blackness is foundational to the establishment of the Western world as we know it. So there's a slight difference between the struggle for land rights and the struggle for like the process of becoming human or non-human. So that's why we find the struggle against slavery is so foundational to what we're doing. But this is also particularly in relation to the U.S. You could make a lot of these same arguments for Latin America, for Africa, for also for Europe, obviously, and even the Middle East to some degree.
I guess in the U.S., it's like anti-blackness is like so ingrained into like the culture, the imaginary, just everything about like American life. And I mean, this is not to say that like the indigenous struggle is like non-existent or not important in the United States. Obviously it is. It's just that when you position yourself in solidarity with like, you know, the black population, that automatically puts you against the entire like establishment of the United States, in my opinion. Because like we said before, you know, the entire, you know, foundation of U.S. society is anti-blackness. So I think once we kind of like get to like, if we focus on that, then we can start to kind of address more of these like other issues. But that's not to say also that these issues have to wait. You know, while we address like, you know, strictly just like black struggle, whatever, it's just more to kind of like, it's just more to emphasize that there is a severe lack of solidarity with, you know, black communities, especially from like, you know, anarchists and other radicals in the United States, and they haven't really had like the proper orientation to connect their struggles with the past struggles of like abolitionism and, you know, the black struggle in general.
And also I'd like to argue that the Civil War in the U.S. was a question that was, the war was fought for a question of resolving the issue of slavery, and that was a war that was never concluded, which is where we find ourselves now, which is why it's so foundational to where we're at and how to combat the political system today.
So one of the major strategic proposals you're making in Burn Down the American Plantation is the creation of a new underground railroad. Can you talk more about this proposal?
Okay, well, we figure that revolutionaries in the U.S., especially in the era of Trump and with the rise of the white supremacists in the country, that we need to wholeheartedly position ourselves with communities that are facing like the forefront of state repression. So like as there's an increase in ICE raids, as there's Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, is calling for an increase in mass incarceration. There's like been targeting of like Muslim communities. We figure that you have to fight side by side with people who are facing this, and that's where revolutionaries have to be ethically and politically. And with that, since, as we said, we position ourselves in saying that the Civil War has never ended in the U.S., we feel that it would be wise to start something like a contemporary underground railroad, which we've been attempting to do, and we position the bail fund in that same kind of avenue. So we think if you can get people out of state captivity, whether it's out of ICE raids, out of the prison industrial complex, out of situations of domestic violence, out of any kind of place where people are held captive, then you're building a stronger revolutionary culture.
One of your immediate strategies is to build RAM as an organization. Can you talk more about why you decided to build a formal organization in a context where it sometimes seems like informal organizing is the norm? And then can you talk a bit about like how formal is it in practice? Mm-hmm. And I know folks have thoughts on like formal, informal as a dichotomy in general, and you can talk more about that too, that'd be great.
I think that we're building a formal organization in that we think there needs to be some kind of like ideological coherence between what we're doing. However, the process of building each of these collectives is fairly informal. So most of us come from an insurrectionist background, but we think the idea of having everything built around temporary affinity groups for a specific action and then dissolving won't solve the problems that we're facing today, and we need something more coherent, more tight, and more expansive. And we also feel that, like, to organize something on the scale we're talking about, like, if we're going to actually try to overthrow the state and have a revolution in a larger sense, that we need to have some kind of like coherent bodies where people can understand how to relate with us and how to bring it back to where they are.
One of the problems with like the insurrectionary movement, especially in the United States, is it has a very reactive tendency to just kind of like appear only when there's a crisis or when there's like, you know, any kind of like, challenge by power or whatever. But you know, it's really only responding to battles, but it's no like long-term like war strategy, which you kind of need if you really realistically believe that you could, you know, implement your ideas concretely in practice and in like everyday life. So I think that whole like dichotomy between the informal and the formal, I think it's, you know, it's like it's not useful, and it only obscures more than it actually clarifies. So. I think, you know, we operate on like both principles, because obviously we have above ground organizations, but we also have, below ground organizations that do other things. There's no like, you know, contradiction between the two. Both of them are like necessary in order for like, you know, the revolutionary transformation of, you know, human society.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, a lot of us think about just like the, like, I mean, they're like the forces that like revolutionaries are facing, not only with like the alt-right and these sort of like non-state far-right groups in the United States who have a certain like war strategy, but also like a connection to existing power structures that are already have a war strategy as well, and just being able to be decentralized and respond over like the long term and actually build.
Anarchists in America, I think, have to grapple with this that fact, in that like the alt-right in the state and the white supremacist movement right now are attacking embattled communities and radicals with a really multi-pronged strategy, while they have like the Proud Boys and the base stick people and all these like far-right boneheads in the street wrestling people. But then they have these same groups are also joining the police forces, they're joining ICE, they're joining they're infiltrating the military. Well, at the same point, they have direct ties to the executive branch, and they're implementing policies at a national and international level. And then, furthermore, then you have Steve Bannon, who is instituting a congressional and Senate strategy to try to put people into different political positions around the country. While anarchists have been mainly focused on the lowest level of fighting these people, which isn't, not to say that shouldn't be done, it has to be done, but we also need to think in a larger scale about how much we're up against and how, quite frankly, we're the only people resisting this, so things could get way more bleak if we don't think in grander terms.
There's also a degree to which, like, different movements being atomized and separate decreases their power in general. So everyone's involved in a bunch of different struggles and projects, and, like, being able to get the resources from different projects and different organizations that have the same people in them anyway, and using those to amplify each other, is a much like more useful way to use the resources that we have, because generally people who are dedicated radicals are a fairly small group, and we want to make the most use of the connections that we have, the skills that we all can share with each other, and the like legitimacy, for lack of a better term, that is provided by the fact that all of these things are done towards one goal or one set of goals, and that it's not just this action happened, there's some kind of marked change that we're trying to make that brings like an abolitionist future, if we could actually do that.
Another one of your strategic proposals in the long term is the development of a neighborhood council system. And in the Truth Out interview, you guys were talking about how you want to do this in the context of building the Underground Railroad. I think in a lot of ways, that's not how a lot of neighborhood assembly type proposals have happened around the world. They seem to start geographically instead of politically. So I'm wondering if you guys can talk about why you think it's strategic to do things in this way, and how does the revolutionary neighborhood council system relate to existing state-backed municipal government? Because that seems to be a big question that goes along with the neighborhood council stuff, too.
To give, like, an example, I guess, like, Bookchin, he had this idea of, like, libertarian municipalism, this idea of, like, using assemblies to, like, you know, take, not necessarily state power, but, like, localized government, kind of, like, you know, let the assemblies take over that, and then eventually, you know, like, the state will go away that way. Since we're, like, basically trying to destroy American society, this is not the direction that we intend on going to. It's actually, you know, we have assemblies basically to connect people who also want to destroy American society and kind of liberate all of the oppressed populations and allow, you know, basically, like, zones of, like, you know, autonomous zones or whatever. And basically, from there, you know, basically coming together, working together, and kind of, like, when you work together on that and the kind of project, you're already working on, like, building that new alternative society rather than kind of taking over what already exists, which a lot of, you know, anarchists kind of like think revolutionary struggle is about. A lot of like anarcho-syndicalist tendencies, you know, feel as though that you can just kind of reappropriate all of the institutions of capitalism and stuff like that and operate them democratically. We don't necessarily agree with that. As we said before, most of these institutions have always been and always will be founded on like anti-blackness and, you know, the negation of like black lives. So I think when you have assemblies that are grounded in these kind of like these kind of alternative politics and like, you know, they're geared towards creating a new society rather than you know, reconfiguring what already exists, I think that's the fundamental difference.
That civil society itself, as Arkamar was mentioning, is itself a state of emergency and is a war zone for a huge amount of people. So we're not trying to replicate anything like that. We think that like we're positioning ourselves within that war. That's a context that we're thinking of. So so it's kind of like a struggle of positions in a sense. So when we're trying to create assemblies and political bodies, it has to do with a certain political analysis first. Now, if you're trying to make a neighborhood assembly, we think that's like that's not something that we would want to knock or criticize. It's something that should be done. But from where we're coming at first, one thing is we're trying to get people who are embattled and bring them into the political sphere and then spread out from there.
Does having publicly revolutionary politics ever hinder the work you do?
All the time, no. No, I mean, it's good to have a public interface with people. So it's like, a lot of stuff we're saying probably to a lot of people sounds scary, but if you have like some kind of like public interface with the general public, then like, yeah, then it's definitely good. There are pitfalls, because obviously, like, there has to be some kind of separation between people doing negative-ass shit and, like, you know, positive, productive shit. So, like, there definitely has to be some kind of split from there, which makes it comes with risks, but there's also probably a way greater reward in the end to actually have something above ground, too.
Right, and I feel it's more sincere to be open about your politics as opposed to, like, doing front groups or stuff like that. And, I mean, if we should feel confident within our own ideas and our own beliefs and, you know, our own analysis and feel that we can, you know, captivate people and get them to, like, join us or, like, join them in, you know, the struggle for, like, collective liberation, so.
And one of the good things about being open to the community, because one of the goals of RAM is to be infused with the community, so we're not, like, a separate entity. We're, like, the neighborhood. You can't distinguish RAM from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Right, because there is that separation kind of like in the logic of leftist organizing of like viewing the community as some kind of separate, otherized entity from like yourself or your group. And in order to have like a successful kind of, I guess, long-term, you know, insurgent strategy, you kind of need to have that kind of like complete mixture and embeddedness with the community. Otherwise, yeah, any kind of like revolt or rebellion will, you know, instantly be like stamped out because you have no popular support.
Yeah. So. A lot of us were organized at the base, which is a political center in Brooklyn. And from the beginning, even though a lot of us are from New York and are some are from Brooklyn, some are from Queens, or a lot of us are from New York. And the main question everyone always had from the activist left is, like, do you have the community there? And then it was like, you know, what do you mean by that? Especially most of the people usually asking that are from, like, Wisconsin or Idaho or something. They always want to know, where is the community? Where is the community? And what they usually mean is they want some kind of nebulous person who has no opinions, who they can shape into their liberal NGO bullshit. And when we're building with the community, it's, like, it's way easier, and it's way more sincere, and it's something that, like, liberals and leftists don't really quite understand because it's not really under the veneer of, like, of having something completely safe or completely, like, regimented. It has to be something a little more pure.
I can also double down and say that if there is a separation, it's one that people allow to continue. Right. So by embracing a kind of situation that might put the militant in a state of illegality, then you're putting yourself on par with somebody else who's deemed illegal by the state. So now you're in it together, and you have to chain yourself together and find a solution.
This is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You're listening to an interview with the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement's New York chapter. We're about to hear part three of the interview. In the final part of this interview with Ram, they talk about the distinction between what they call revolutionary justice and conflict resolution. They also talk about patriarchy and the liberation of women, as well as being a being a revolutionary under capitalism. A warning that this final section of the interview contains swear words.
So in that Truth Out interview that I don't know if it was originally in Truth Out. Anyways, the interview that ended up in Truth Out that I was talking about earlier, you guys talk about the difference between revolutionary justice and conflict resolution as being the difference between dealing with those in power versus dealing with comrades. And I'm wondering if you guys can expand on this and talk about why the distinction is important to you.
I guess to put it bluntly, it's just that for the people who, you know, we fight alongside towards the goal of liberation, that kind of demands a certain level of seriousness, respect, you know, love, everything. Because these are people, you know, who you plan on, like, struggling with, you know, for the long term. And, you know, to engage in, like, activities like the ones that we're doing requires, you know, a lot of, like, basically a lot of care and support, which is kind of lacking in a lot of, like, activist spaces. And, you know, there's a very toxic culture that exists in a lot of activist spaces where, you know, we're not able to really care for our own in a way that's sustainable and that allows for kind of, like, you know, a multi-generational kind of movement. But I guess with regards to, like, you know, everyone else, or more, like, specifically, like, our enemies, people who, like, are against this kind of goal of, like, collective, you know, liberation. I personally do not, like, care for their, like, well-being or anything like that. To me, if you stand in the way of, like, the collective liberation of, like, humanity and, like, non-human entities and stuff like that, then, you know, you shouldn't, like, why would you be against that if you're, like, if you think of yourself as a good person or whatever like that? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, if you, you know, are invested in, like, the perpetuation of these systems of, like, oppression and domination, then your life ain't worth shit, you know? So it's like, it's either you get with, like, you know, liberation and stuff like that, or you get, like, blown away once we, like, ran through you. Yeah.
What's the banana quote?
Yeah, a person who oppresses another, their life isn't worth a cent. And,
right. Right.
Yeah. And from the French Revolution, what is it? Those who built revolutions halfway just dig their own graves.
Right, exactly. And that, and, you know, history has been, you know, shown that, you know, that has some, if you don't finish off your enemies, then you're going to be, like, fucked, especially with things like the Spanish Revolution. I mean, it's like, you know, they nearly destroyed the state, but they did not, like, you know, handle their enemies correctly or, like, efficiently, so, and then, you know, they ended up rolling back everything that they had, you know, won during the revolution. So I think abandoning is kind of, like, this very, like, moralistic view of, like, people who, I guess, are, like, against you or whatever, instead of, like, viewing them as human or whatever, like, kind of morality to, like, justify whatever they do. I think it should just be, you know, if you're for the cause of liberation and, you know, you're down to fight, that's cool, it's great. Even if you're not doing, like, the same things we are or what we're doing. But if you, again, if you, like, stand in the way of that process, then, you know, you should expect, like, a reaction. At this point in, like, in human history, it's like, it's a now or never moment. It's like, either, like Book Chin said, it's like anarchism or annihilation. So it's like,
yeah,
you know, this is the side that we chose, and if you choose the other side, then...
So do you guys see a difference between dealing with harm versus dealing with conflict within the movement? And if so, what's the difference?
Okay, I could give an example to start talking about this question. In a great interview I read about the Zapatistas, someone gave an example of conflict resolution that has deeply moved me and stayed with me. And I think I'm trying to integrate that into the kind of work we're doing here. And the example was that someone had killed another family's son, and they had to think of a way to mediate the situation. Incarceration wasn't an option. Kicking them out of the community wasn't an option. So they had to sit down and come to a resolution. So that I could see that as, like, the ultimate harm you could do somebody. You take their life away, you've harmed the community, you've harmed their loved ones. And this is a really big question, because, of course, every time we talk to people about prison abolition, they say, but what about the killers? So the Zapatistas provided an incredible answer. They sat down, the family, the person who had killed, and a mediator, and the idea was that they had to talk through what had happened, and they had to come to a conclusion that everybody agreed to, including the person who perpetuated the harm. The solution was, beyond all the emotional upheaval, that the family had lost somebody that was an integral part of their lives and somebody that helped them do the daily work of maintaining their house and maintaining their crops. So the solution was that the killer would go and live with the family for a year as restitution. This is inconceivable in our society, that somebody who would perpetuate a harm on another would then be accepted into their lives. but there's something really interesting about this lesson, because it showed an incredible amount of strength on the part of the family, that they would go to that length to remediate the situation. And it showed an incredible amount of strength on the person who had done the killing, because he had to face every day the family, the person he killed, and deal with their grief. So in that, I think there's an incredible lesson for us, because we're very quick to issue a punishment and deem somebody as bad and irrevocable. Like, there's nothing we can do to salvage this person. So I think there's a great lesson in there that we can learn from as revolutionaries, as people who are for prison abolition, that you can't give up on somebody, that if everybody is willing to work together to try to remediate, like, the social fabric, then you can always work. There's something to work with.
I'd also like to add, too, that within revolutionary groups, people should probably be really clear about what the positions are, where they stand on issues, what are, like, non-negotiable, what is permitted within a collective. Because a lot of times it's like a nebulous framework where it's like we're all a group of friends, and then somebody does something that, like, you know, it's either really, sometimes it's really terrible, sometimes it's like, you know, it depends who views what, and but there's no real discussion beforehand, before any activities, before any actions, about what is too much, you know. And the more there's clarity, and the more there's like a firm understanding of where we all should stand with each other, I think we'll all be a lot better off. And I'm, once again, I'm not trying to say we have all the answers to these things, because these are really complex social and political questions. So,
in Burn Down the American Plantation, you guys talk about women's liberation being tied to the destruction of the state. Can you expand on that?
Right. So yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, I guess, like, the origins of the state and stuff like that, then you kind of, like, understand, you know, how crucial patriarchy was in terms of, like, the development of, like, the state and then, you know, like, everything else that came out of that. And, you know, in Rojava, it, I think it shows, like, you know, how seriously, like, you know, they... You have to take kind of like a feminist praxis that, you know, really, really puts into question the dynamics, the power dynamics that, you know, gender, you know, imposes on us. And so the way that the state operates and has always operated, it has always encouraged, you know, the violence and the domination of women, you know, and always have relegated them into like objects for like the reproduction of like society and stuff like that, and, you know, imposing these gender roles onto them and stuff like that. So, you know, the struggle against patriarchy goes hand in hand, you know, with the struggle against the state, just like how they feel in like Rojava. So
yeah, and it's important too that when you look at like the history of the United States in particular, you can go back to the role of slavery, and that this kind of patriarchal domination is intertwined with that history. So being able to own a person, to own a woman, that her reproduction is also the production of your capital, it's completely intertwined with that development. So the destruction of the state is essential for any kind of gender liberation, like liberation of gender roles, or from freeing up the gender binary, which is something that the state is completely dependent on to perpetuate the kind of stereotypes that make it work.
When is it appropriate to critique revolutionary movements in other places, or in the place where you are, but that aren't you, and that you have a relationship with? And what do you think are appropriate ways of going about doing that critique?
I would argue that I think that critiques of other movements and revolutionary groups, I think internally it's good to have them consistently to know what people are doing. To you have to look at things critically. You're doing what other people are doing. I think you should do that pretty standardly. I think when it's a public critique, it has to, one, has to be over some really big deviations from what everyone's working towards, and two, it should also have to do under, it should be under a framework of what you're all trying to accomplish. So it's, you know, there's a certain pragmatic thought that should go into that first.
There's a split between, I think, academic world, the journalistic world, and the revolutionary world, which hasn't aided our cause in any way. And the main problem is that critique is taken as paramount, the best practice that anybody could do. On the contrary, I think when you strive to become a revolutionary, what you're looking at is trying to create the vision of a better world that people think is impossible. Mm-hmm. If people come into your world and they see people getting at each other's throats, they see people being belittled online, they see small projects with the best intentions being ripped to shreds, that's not a world anyone's going to want to join. So we hope that by laying out the principles, and our principles, that we will keep all of our critiques of other movements internal and based on pragmatics, that will actually be building better relationships between revolutionary groups so that a lot of people can be working towards the same goals and not have the fear that they're going to be criticized unnecessarily or ripped down before they even have achieved anything.
What does it mean to you guys to be a revolutionary under capitalism? What makes people able to focus their political activities full-time and spend less of their time at work?
I think the first thing to be like a revolutionary under capitalism means that, you know, you're basically willing to, like, you know, I don't want to say sacrifice, but, like, you're willing to put your life on the line to, like, you know, towards the liberation of, like, oppressed peoples. I feel like there's, like, real solidarity is when, you know, you put yourself in, you know, the dire positions of people who, you know, you proclaim to be in solidarity with. Not just, like, approaching it as, like, you know, you have your life, they have their life. But you're kind of trying to, like, bring both of those lives together and kind of, like, work towards the same ends. So yeah, you know, just, like, having that understanding that revolution is not like some, you know, some, like, tea party or whatever, and kind of just acknowledging that, you know, to build a revolutionary society is, like, a lifelong investment. And it's one that requires you to take risks and put your own life at risk.
That was an interview with the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement's New York City chapter. If you want to reach out and get in touch with RAM, you can check out their website at revolutionaryabolition.org, where you will find an online copy of the book Burn Down the American Plantation. It's free. There is a contact form on their website that you can use to email them. If you don't have access to the internet and want to get in touch, you can write to them. Their address is RAMNYC, Support Through the Walls, 113 Stockholm Street, number 1. They're located in Brooklyn, New York, 11221. And the time is currently 11:54, and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and CQT.ca.
On Thursday, December 7th, the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar will be doing a launch of the 2018 calendar at Le Eugélien Feminist Bookstore, which is located at 1426 Beaudry. The event will be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. The event will be in French with whisper translation towards English. The Certain Days calendar is a joint fundraising and educational project between outside organizers in Montreal, Toronto, and New York, in partnership with three political prisoners being held in maximum security prisons in New York State, David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes, and Herman Bell. The event is free, and copies of the Certain Days calendar will be available for $15. The event will be in French, with whisper translation into English, as I said before. The space is wheelchair accessible, and there's more information on the website of the bookstore if you're wondering about specific accessibility information. Childcare will be available, and snacks will be served. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com, and you can also follow us on Twitter, at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next episode of the Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, December 14th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Noah.
My name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
Job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had. Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I was.